Welcome to Nature Calls, conversations from the Hudson Valley. Our team's goal is to present science-based information about gardening and all things nature in New York's Hudson Valley. Hosts Gene and Tim, along with team members
Teresa, Linda, and Annie,
are master gardener volunteers for New York's Columbia and Green Counties. So if you're interested in gardening or nature or nuggets of information about what's happening outside your door, settle in. Enjoy the conversation. Whatever the season, we have something to say.
Hi, I'm Tim Kennelty.
And I'm Jean Thomas.
And welcome to Nature Calls, conversations from the Hudson Valley. We're here in Ithaca at our road trip at Cornell University, and we're talking to some great people, aren't we, Jean?
We are. In fact, our current victim guest is Paul Curtis, who's being very tolerant of our crazy antics. Paul is officially the Department Extension Leader, Department of Natural Resources and the Environment on campus. Dr. Curtis has agreed to sit with us and chat about a few of his projects.
Paul, welcome. We're really happy to have you here. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about your background and how you got to be here with us today.
Well, that's a long story. I'll make it brief as possible. I'm a wildlife ecologist and serve as Extension Wildlife Specialist for New York State with Cornell Cooperative Extension. And my program areas dealt with human-wildlife interactions for the past 30 years almost. And I came to Ithaca in 1990 from North Carolina State University and helped college develop a program in wildlife damage management or resolving human-wildlife conflicts.
That's amazing that you've been here that long. And I assume that things have changed over that time period.
Many things have changed, particularly in terms of technology. People expect immediate responses now, whether it be internet, phone, the old days of letters and faxes are long gone. But the actual wildlife issues, surprisingly, haven't changed all that much. We deal with the same species we did 30 years ago. Primarily, the bulk of my calls are white-tailed deer, Canada geese, rodents, and that same list of critters pops up year after year.
So it's not just predators, it's deer and geese and turkeys and all those things that can run into your vehicle.
Absolutely. And predators are probably the minority in terms of calls I receive from county associations across the state. I would say deer top the list, followed by a variety of bird-related issues, geese on the lawn, birds and fruit crops, all sorts of things similar to that.
I know we want to talk about bear and coyotes, but I just want to ask you first about deer, because it's such a huge thing in terms of insurance and cost and injuries. And is there anything over that period of time that you've seen that has helped prevent those interactions between deer and vehicles?
Probably the thing that helps prevent deer vehicle interactions the best is public education, doing what we're doing today, because it's driver behavior that's really going to make the change. People needed to realize that 2/3 of the deer vehicle accidents that occur every year occur during October, November, and December. We know what happens in November.
It's
the peak of the rut, the breeding season, and deer crossing highways more and vehicle collisions go up. So we can sort of train motorists to be more attentive, maybe drive a little slower, pay particular attention near dawn and dusk, those peak activity times for deer, then potentially we can reduce the number of accidents.
So not to get into the details too much, but rut season, I've always heard that because the male deer are just so crazed that they're running, or is it that there's more movement? Why is it that there's so many collisions during the rut?
During the rut, male deer are chasing females, so their home ranges are a little bit larger because they're trying to come in contact with as many females as possible. And the female deer are paying less attention because they're being chased by bucks. And so both those things increase the number of potential interactions. Also, during that time in November, the peak in deer activity around dusk and dawn coincides with the peak of dawn and evening driving activity while we go to work, we go to school, other places. So it's just sort of a perfect storm creating this combination of factors that allows deer vehicle accidents to go up.
Okay, I got a technical question. Those little beeper thingies that you stick on your bumper, are they any good?
You're referring to the deer whistles.
Yeah,
right.
And there really isn't any good research evidence that show they work. We're not even sure that deer can hear in the ultrasonic range, and the ultrasound that these give off probably is less than the tire noise from the tires wearing on the highway from your vehicle. So I really don't like it because it creates a false sense of security.
Right.
People put something on their vehicles and think it's going to solve a problem, and it's not.
And if you're driving a Prius, you're really in trouble.
Yeah, definitely really in trouble with a smaller vehicle. And if you get into larger animals, it's not just deer that we have collision with, but if you get farther north and east, then you've got to worry about moose.
Moose, right.
And do moose have the same rut season?
A similar time period. They're active in the fall. But the problem with moose, they're so much larger and so much taller, they're not going to hit your front bumper. They're going to come through the windshield, and that's going to be much more devastating for both the driver and the moose.
And have the deer-driver interactions increased because there's a higher population of deer over the last, say, 10, 20 years, something like that, or has it stayed pretty stagnant?
Well, the number of deer vehicle accidents varies, depends where you're at. The overall trend is probably a slight increase, one, because deer densities have increased in many parts of the Northeast over the last two decades, but also miles driven has also increased. So
right.
It's really a probability of contact issue. You've got a lot of high-speed highway in areas where deer are common and abundant. The number of potential accidents is going to increase. Where communities have gotten very aggressive and wanted to solve the issue, gone in with very intensive deer culling programs, you can reduce accidents by half or more just by reducing deer density.
Huh.
But that gets to be controversial in many communities.
Okay, with COVID and people changing over to hybrid work schedules where they go to work 2 days a week instead of five, is there any appreciable or measurable difference in the amount of mileage and danger?
That's a really good question. There probably, at least initially with COVID, was quite a reduction in miles driven. But based on just anecdotally what I see today to day, I would suspect we're probably pretty close to what it was pre-COVID at this point.
And I don't know if there's any science behind this. This is my anecdotal observations, is the deer seem to be getting more tame. And I don't know if there's any kind of studies. I mean, I basically can walk right up to deer on my property, and I don't remember that 10 years ago. Are they just getting used to humans more, or is there no real evidence of that?
In urban areas where deer frequently see people and there are no negative interactions, i.e. suburbia where they're not hunted, deer do adapt to our schedules and get used to us. And if we present no real danger, they're not going to show any type of a flight or avoidance response. And urban deer often behave very differently from rural deer. And you ask any of your probably deer hunting friends or family members how difficult it is to try to get close to one in the woods. Whereas, like you said, in many urban areas where they're not hunted, you can walk up fairly close. You're on campus. When the red oak acorns are dropping along Tower Road, sometimes there are deer feeding on acorns 15 feet away from hundreds of students walking up and down the road.
Yeah. I'm in a rural area and there's hunters, but I think they're just not afraid of me for some reason.
I'll explain that later, Jim.
Yeah. I mean, maybe that's it.
Yeah. Okay. Paul, we connect you with the National Wildlife Control Training Program. You were a sponsor of it. You began the whole setup.
I'm one of the co-authors of the National Wildlife Control Training Program. It was a partnership initially between Dr. Scott Hengstrom and myself. Scott was with the University of Nebraska at the time. Now he's with the University of Wisconsin. Scott had developed a booklet, Prevention Control of Wildlife Damage, which was sort of the handbook for the Midwest and Western states. And I worked with the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation staff to develop best practices for nuisance wildlife control, which was a New York-based manual. And there's a lot of similarities and overlap. We dealt with a lot of the same species and issues. So Scott and I decided to partner to create the National Wildlife Control Training Program. And what that is, it's a basic course, just a very straightforward basic course for new people who want to get into the wildlife control business. In New York and about 10 other states now, if you complete the online course, and you can get a certificate of completion, and those states that recognize it will then allow people that have completed the course to get a wildlife control operator's license for dealing with wildlife pests. Again, not everyone needs that, but if you're going to do it as a commercial business, you have to be licensed. The average homeowner can deal with pests on his or her property without a license, and as long as they follow state regulations and guidelines. But if you're going to do it commercially, you need to be licensed.
That's a huge accomplishment to make there be an entirely national, but a consistent criterion across that many states. That's pretty remarkable.
And how do you define nuisance wildlife? Could it be anything from a raccoon to a goose to a, I don't know, possum? To, and could it be a wide range of different animals?
It can be a wide range of species. Under environmental conservation law in New York, there's a list that sort of many of the common species, squirrels, rabbits, deer, raccoons, opossums, I could go down. There's 20, 30 species.
And that's something, there's a link that we could include in the show notes for folks who are interested.
Yeah, and the regulations under nuisance wildlife laws are Section 1105.23 of the Environmental Conservation Regulation.
So there's certain things you can do with certain animals.
Correct.
In terms of, so if I have a squirrel in my basement, there's certain things I can do and can't do, I assume.
That's correct. And the challenge is that those state laws vary. The federal laws are pretty consistent across states, so it's much easier to teach the federal laws what you can and can't do. But each state has its own specific sets of laws and regulation, and they're not always compatible. So that was the biggest challenge with the National Wildlife Control Training Program, is to customize it for each state so that it met current state regulations. And so it requires changing from time to time as regulations change.
Okay, here's a question. When you pass the bar, you have to pass bar different tests in different states. Would you take different certifications of this for different states?
Typically, it's within a single state. They, unfortunately, we don't have the sort of the co-recognition between states. So, because each state wildlife agency, again, has different sets of regulations and expectations.
Yeah, because we are on the cusp of three different states, and I just wondered if maybe they could get, can they get a separate one for each state?
A person technically can get a separate license for each state.
Okay, so that could work, yeah.
But if I hire like a nuisance person, because again, I have a squirrel in my basement, which I did at one point, and I didn't hire someone, I did it myself. But if I did hire, they'd be licensed, I assume, in New York State.
In New York State, they require to be licensed to be legal.
Okay.
And to be licensed, they have to pass your test?
They have to pass the online certification test. Now it's almost all people take it online. Used to be years ago, before online was so frequent, people could take it at a DEC regional office and they would offer the test in person a couple times a year, but we're seeing that happen less and less frequently. Most people are taking online just for the convenience factor.
Huh. So can we branch off and talk a little bit about some of the really, I don't know, things that people ask us a lot, or I don't know, when somebody comes to visit me, they're always worried about bears or coyotes. Can we talk a little bit about coyotes? Because we have lots of coyotes where I live, and we hear them a lot, and I kind of worry about our dogs. And are coyotes pretty aggressive, or are they more afraid of us?
Coyotes are really more afraid of us. Back in, I'm trying to think when we started, probably 2005, 2006, we had a collaborative project with New York State DEC. And we looked at coyote complaints across New York State regionally, and it seemed like the two hot spots in the state for coyote complaints were Lower Hudson Valley, no big surprise for you, and just south of Rochester in Monroe County, in sort of the central part of the state, that seemed to be another hot spot. But coyote conflicts pop up around the state. One thing that became really obvious from the data set was that a lot of the complaints that were coming in to the DEC regional offices were from more urban areas, urban-rural fringe. And so, again, that makes sense with Lower Hudson Valley with a high human population density. And very seldom do we see many reports come in from places like St. Lawrence County or Excess County and Adirondacks. I think landowners have grown up with coyotes, know how to deal with coyotes, and they take care of the problem, so it never reaches the state wildlife agency.
Call them coyotes. Maybe I should call them coyotes. I like that.
coyotes.
and what do I do if I encounter them, or if I'm walking my dog at 11 o'clock at night and there's a pack of coyotes?
Yeah, it's unlikely to be a pack. Usually animals forage individually. Sometimes you may see a pair foraging together. For small dogs, it's a concern. You really need to have your dog on leash close to you. It's the conflicts happen with dogs that are typically 15 pounds or less. And if a coyote catches a small dog off leash in its territory, they're very territorial. That dog will be likely be dead, probably kill it.
Is that what you call fair game?
Is it because it's a dog and it's of the same
species? It's another canid within their home range.
So they wouldn't do that to a cat?
They will kill a cat occasionally, but again, people have the misperception that they're out targeting cats as a food source. I've seen two New York coyote diet studies now, and both of those studies cats were in less than 1% of the coyotes' cats. And who knows, they might have been roadkilled and scavenged along the roadside. So coyotes don't usually go out and target cats. It's not a food item.
Oh, so it's more, that's really interesting, though, that it's more that that dog's in their territory than I want to eat that dog.
That's correct.
Huh, that's really interesting.
Yeah, and they'll do the same thing with foxes. If they can catch a fox in their territory, it's another canid in their territory they don't want around. Medium and large-sized dogs, 30, 40-pound dogs and up, they may bark and get aggressive towards, but they rarely attack. It's just small dogs that they know, I can take this one.
Right. My dog's 17 pounds. You think that's the right?
That's the right size. I keep it on leash.
Fatten him up.
If only. If fatten him up, exactly. What about wolves? Are we seeing wolves in New York State?
Occasionally, we get a confirmed wolf in New York State. In my 30-plus years here, I think I can remember offhand maybe four confirmed wolves in New York State.
Yeah,
there's no breeding population. Right. Occasionally, an animal ends up here. We don't always know the source population. Sometimes they're illegally kept domestic animals that go wild. Mm-hmm. Maybe an animal comes in from the north out of Canada. Same thing with mountain lions. People always say, oh, we've got mountain lions in New York State. Well, show me. I've yet to see a good evidence of breeding populations of mountain lions. Yes, one occasionally occurs. I've seen one on Homeland Security Bureau from Essex County with a large cat with a long tail and couldn't have been much else. We had one that was roadkill in Connecticut several years ago that passed through New York State, but the animal left scat and other obvious signs as it passed through the state. So we just don't see that sign anywhere that would indicate that we've got breeding populations. Occasionally, an animal ends up in New York
kind
for whatever
wanders
reason.
Wanders in
or gets illegal pet that's released.
Yeah.
And we see one, but otherwise they're not here.
So the cats we do see are bobcats?
Bobcats primarily. And people often mistake bobcats for mountain lions. But when you actually see the two side by side, you realize that these things are really different. But people would see a bobcat with a long legs, bigger body size.
Yeah, if it's a big cat.
But again, the body conformation and head size is completely different than for a mountain lion.
And they're pretty shy, right, bobcats? I mean, I've seen, I think, two in 30 years. And so with dogs and with children, we don't really have to worry about bobcats, I assume, as far as interactions.
Definitely. Bobcats really don't want to be around people like you. I think I've seen three in my 30-plus years here in New York State. But even with coyotes, they're not easily seen. They really don't want to interact with people. We did a coyote study in Westchester County several years ago and had 40 animals radio collared. And we were out there tracking them daily and rarely saw them. And we knew right where they were at, still couldn't see them. They did everything possible to avoid us, even though they were living in very suburban areas in Westchester County.
Are they pretty much omnivores, coyotes?
It depends. They're classified as carnivores, and during 9 months of the year, they're primarily carnivores. From like January through September, October, you look at the diet studies from New York, and the bulk of their diets is rodents and deer. Yeah, but then in the fall, it's interesting. When you get in September, October, November, this time of year, about half their diet's plant material. They're taking all sorts of different nuts and fruits and things like that. And so the diet does change. It's very similar to what you'd see for foxes. They're carnivores again, but they do take some fruits and other things as they become available.
It's because of availability, not because of nutrition requirements.
Correct. It's as things become available, take advantage of
it. It's easier, right? I mean, I assume that.
So an acorn's a snack.
Yeah, or grapes in the fall, for example, when the grapes are ripe, then they may take something like that.
Yeah. Okay, pick the next critter.
Yeah, I mean, this is so much fun hearing about this. So we've been seeing and hearing a lot more about black bears, and I'm just wondering if it's just because people are talking about it, or are there really a lot more bear interactions over the last few years?
Yeah, again, it really depends where you're at in New York State. If you go, say, north by 90 in the Adirondack region, bear numbers have been fairly stable. DEC estimates there are about, I think, around 4,000, 4,500 bears in the Adirondacks, northern New York. Now, if you look across the southern tier in southeastern New York State, bear numbers have increased over the last two decades. And so what we see is historically there were three distinct bear ranges. There was the Allegheny Bear Range in the southwestern New York. There was the Catskill Bear Range in southeastern New York. And then there was the Adirondack Bear Range in the North Country. Well, what's happened is those two subpopulations in the southern half of the state have merged now. Now we have a southern bear range and a northern bear range. And it's in all likelihood, those may emerge at some point as bear numbers continue to increase in the southern part of the state.
So is it, as probably everything else is, because of humans interfering and making it easier for them to, and in a lot of cases, I'm sure they're making life easier for the bears.
Yeah, not so much it's human influence as it is changes in environment. And then, you know, like with deer, bears, the litter size is tied to fat reserve. So the better your diet, the more fat that you have, the larger the litter size. So, for example, the typical litter size in white-tailed deer is 2 fawns. Most adult females have 2 fawns. But in urban suburban areas where you've got supplemental foods, bird feeders, garden crops, landscape ornamentals, and they're on a higher diet plan, 10% or more of those deer might have triplets.
Wow. Oh, joy.
And wow. We'll see the same thing with bears. Is the typical litter size years ago used to be 2 cubs. Now we frequently see adult females with 3 cubs, and I've seen occasional reports of 4 cubs. And so, again, as that diet and habitat quality is improved for these animals, we see a reproductive response.
So why is the habitat improving for bears, but it's not improving for, say, certain bird species? Are they able to eat, you know, invasive plants or something like that? Why is that habitat getting better? Is it human garbage or what is happening?
It can be human garbage and food dumps in some cases, but it's often, I think, too, partly climate-related with milder climate in the fall. Some years you might have a bumper mass crop and that animal put on more fat. So I think it's just a variety of factors. You can't point your finger at any one thing and say, yeah, here's the cause.
But their populations are increasing.
In the southern part of the state, numbers are generally going up over the last two decades.
Is there a correlation with climate change?
I wouldn't say a correlation with climate change. It's hard to correlate wildlife changes with climate change because there's natural year-to-year variability. Okay. But if we look at long-term trends, as winters get milder, we tend to see increases sometimes in rodent population abundance. We get to see increases in potential disease spread that we may not have seen in the past. Yeah. So there are a lot of things that are interrelated with climate.
So now my question is, in the middle of the winter and what's a million degrees out, do bears hibernate anymore?
Yes, bears definitely hibernate, and it really depends on the age and the sex of the animal. Usually the first bears to go to den in the fall are the pregnant females. They'll often go into the den this time of year, mid to late October. Usually the last animals to go to den are the juvenile males. And so young males occasionally will see tracks on snow in early December in the winter months before they go to den, but they will eventually den.
So when you say to go to den, where do they go? They're going to hollow logs, or I'm thinking of Yogi the Bear. You know, are there den opportunities for all these bears?
There absolutely are den opportunities for all these bears, and it's extremely variable again. I've seen bears den under people's decks in their backyard, and that's plenty of cover. Just get them out of wind and get them out of snow cover. The most typical bear den that we saw when I was doing research on Fort Drum years ago was a blowdown tree with a big root wad. And as long as the root wad sort of faced west, northwest to block the wind, the bear would curl up underneath that blowdown and live out the winter. I've seen him den in brush piles. I've seen him, the more typical den, in rock crevices that, you know, probably we're all familiar with, or an excavated den in a sand pile or sand berm. So they'll use a variety of different things to den. Basically, all they need is something that's going to break up the wind and keep snow off of them during the winter months.
So there can be, it can be open.
It can be completely open. I've seen them den completely above ground. Temperature doesn't bother them. It's the wind and the snow that is what they're trying to get away from.
And what happens if they don't hibernate? Do they die?
I've never known bears. You're not the hibernator.
Okay.
And then the female is going to give birth to offspring while she's hibernating.
She is. And she is. In the den.
In the den. Okay. So the peak birth period tends to be late January, early February. So we're usually doing winter den checks in mid to late February. So when the cubs are just a few weeks old, we could handle them and take care of samples for DNA analysis, and then put them right back in the den with mom.
And how big is a baby bear?
A baby bear is just a few pounds. It's not now. It's a handful.
Yeah,
I'd say 3 to 4 pounds for the ones we typically see. Again, they're a lot smaller when they're first born, but we try not to bother them in the den during until they're a few weeks old. So I typically, again, February, mid to late February is often when we like to do den checks. So the cubs are a few weeks old at that point. It's amazing they're already mobile. Their claws are very sharp. They can climb if they need to climb at that point, but they're really dependent on mom in the den for overwinter.
And when do they emerge from the den generally?
You tend to emerge late March, early April.
Okay.
It depends, again, on mildness of the spring. If we get 70-degree days in late March, no reason the bear's not going to be out. Well, we've got a foot of snow on the ground in late March, then more likely not in the den.
So my selfish hanging up bird feeders question is, it sounds like I can do it like February to March almost if I want to keep away the bears.
Yeah, I would say you're safe pretty much December to March.
Okay.
And that's when the birds probably could use a supplement. Anyhow, during the summer month, even though I enjoy feeding birds too, they really don't need the food in many cases. Plenty of other natural things to eat.
Yeah, 2 years ago I had feeders on my deck and the bear came right up onto the deck. So I guess that's pretty common.
Yeah. The number one bear complaint in New York State is damage to bird feeder. Mm. Probably the second most common is damage to trash, people putting trash all on the road. Very seeing that as a food source. But that's invariably what gets people in the conflict with bears, providing food sources inadvertently, and then the bears take advantage of that and get in trouble.
So far in this conversation, we've touched on various aspects of human-wildlife interactions, from deer-vehicle collisions to the behavior of coyotes and the emergence of black bears. Paul has such a wealth of knowledge that we'd like to explore further, so we're extending this discussion into two parts. Join us for part two, where we'll take a more in-depth look at the specific wildlife challenges and conservation initiatives shaping the Hudson Valley.
That concludes another episode of Nature Calls, Conversations from the Hudson Valley. We would like to thank Sandra Powers and Devin Connolly from Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties for production support. And a special thank you to our listeners for joining us on this episode of Nature Calls, Conversations from the Hudson Valley. You can find links to any of the topics mentioned in this episode at our website at ccecolumbiagreen.org. Comments and suggestions for future topics may be directed to us at columbiagreenmgb@cornell.edu or on the CCE Master Gardener Volunteers of Columbia and Greene Counties Facebook page. For more information about Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties, visit our website at ccecolumbiagreen.org or visit us in Hudson or in Acre. Cornell Cooperative Extension provides equal programming and employment opportunities.